The twinkling, shifting light spun in bright globes. Quentin could see them, even though his eyes were closed. He traced their play on his eyelids for hours, half waking, half dreaming. How long he had lain watching the dancing lights and listening for the crystalline song of the bells, he did not know. Maybe hours, maybe days, maybe forever. Quentin, in his twilight world between darkness and light, drifted in and out of consciousness almost at will, and was aware of nothing but the shifting globes of light, sometimes red or blue, but most often a rosy golden hue. He perceived nothing but the lights and the intonation of the tiny chimes. The room where Quentin lay commanded a western view of a range of low forested mountains. They rose and fell in gentle folds, like the thick bristly fur of some mythical beast sleeping peacefully through the ages. From the balcony's high parapet, one could look to the west and the fiery descent of the setting sun. And every afternoon, the earthward trail of the falling sun brought the light full through the arched double doors which opened onto the balcony. The light washed over Quentin's inert form, transfiguring him from a pale waxen image into a creature of living light. A wind chime hanging at the apex of the arch danced in the light breeze, which capered now and then in through the open doors. An old woman in a white woolen shawl sat near Quentin's high, wide bed. She held in her hands a small jar of aromatic unguent, which she periodically applied to a spot just over Quentin's heart and to his temples. A steady train of visitors throughout the day came to stand at the foot of Quentin's bed, or merely to step inside the door. They looked to the old woman, always with the same question in their eyes, and always they left with the same reply in kind. No change. Derwin relieved the old woman from time to time, sitting for hours gazing upon the motionless body stretched before him. In the evening, he brought a cup of lukewarm broth, which he administered to Quentin by means of his short, hollow tube of bone. Derwin let the broth trickle slowly down Quentin's throat, careful not to choke him. There was never any response. Derwin had just administered the broth one evening when Thedo came to the room.
Still no change.
None. He hovers between life and death. Sometimes I think he might awaken. He looks about to rise up, but the moment passes away and he is the same.
Can he recover, do you think? It has been nearly 2 months.
I do not know. I have never seen this kind of illness before. Certainly no one recovers from the poison of the Sharth. Still, the people of Dekra have many powers unknown in the world abroad. And had his wound been deeper or closer to the mark, this old woman's art would not have mattered. He would have died within the hour, or out on the trail. We came for nothing. It is my fault that he is stricken so.
Do not blame yourself, sir. If fault is to be found, we need not look further than Jaspin's door. 'Twas he who loosed the Harriers.
Still, our purpose in coming here has come to naught. And our number has already been diminished. It was my willfulness and pride, Thedo. That is why young Quentin suffers now.
It was your healing skill, good hermit. That is why he still draws breath. We cannot wait any longer, Derwin. We must leave by week's end. The ships will be sailing soon from their winter's harborage. We must secure a ship to take us to Karsh.
You think you will find a merchant who will endanger his ship so?
For the king, yes.
For no king or kingdom. The fate of a king matters little to these sailors. They care nothing for the rise and fall of nations. Their loyalty swings by the heft of your purse.
Then the captain that enjoins our enterprise shall have a king's ransom for his troubles. I can guarantee that. The queen herself will vouch it.
Do not be so sure. They are a wild and superstitious lot, worse than peasants when it comes to charms and sacrifices. Karsh may hold a power over them which even the love of gold cannot release.
We shall see. Anyway, we have no other plan. We cannot fly.
No, I suppose not. I doubt if even old Nimrud could foresee that.
It had been meant as a joke, but Thedo remained grave at the mention of the magician's name.
Do you think the necromancer sees so much? Does he know of our enterprise?
Undoubtedly he knows. Whether by art or by spies, he knows we are abroad. But I do not think he considers a party of five.
Four.
Derwin was about to continue when Alenia stepped into the room. She went to the bed and placed a warm hand on Quentin's cool forehead. She looked sadly upon his upturned face, and then stepped over to where the men stood talking.
Is there nothing more we can do?
All that can be done has been accomplished. Now we must watch and wait.
Yes, I know, so you told me often enough. I only wish there was something that could sway the balance. These weeks have not been easy ones.
Our wait is nearly at an end. We must leave at week's end to begin our journey to the island Tildene. The ships will be sailing again soon, and I am anxious to secure our passage.
Then we must leave him?
I think it is for the best. He cannot travel as he is, that much is obvious. Even if he were to recover, he would be still too weak to travel for weeks to come. No, we must leave him here. The Kuratok will take care of him. When he is strong enough, he can return to Ascalon. Toli will bring him safely as far as Pelgrim.
Yes, it is for the best. We know not what the outcome of our mission might be. 'Twere better for Quentin that he abide safely in Derwin's cottage.
It will break his heart to find us gone. He has come this far only to be denied.
It cannot be helped, my lady.
Thedo, too, felt badly that Quentin, who had shown himself to be a stalwart and worthy companion, should now have to remain behind.
When do we leave, you say? By week's end? I will compose a letter of safe conduct for him, should Jaspin's men be roaming the way.
Do you think that will matter very much?
The queen paused and looked at the two men sorrowfully.
No, but it is the one thing I can do.
Yes, I shall compose a letter myself explaining all that has happened and what we intend. That should help ease his mind that we have not abandoned him unreasonably.
Good, a fine idea. I will begin seeing to our provisions and equipment.
As with most knights, Thedo did not like leaving a fallen comrade behind in any circumstances that he could improve. He left the room with a more resolute tread than he had entered it. His mind was at ease now.
I do not know.
What troubles you, friend Derwin? Is there something more?
More than I am telling? Yes, I do admit it.
Derwin moved to Quentin's bed and sat down on the edge. He placed his hand upon the boy's chest for a moment.
I told him once that he had some part to play in this. So I still believe. But the god I serve has not illumined me more precisely, I am afraid.
Derwin gazed fondly down upon the motionless form beside him.
It could be. This is the beginning for him, not the end.
Queen Alenia nodded silently and placed her hand on the hermit's shoulder. After a few moments of silence, they left together, leaving Quentin's care once more to the old woman. The snow lay melting in Ascalon's inner ward yard. The high, windswept dome of the sky appeared spotless and clean, heralding an early spring. Servants of various ranks scurried across the yard, avoiding the mud and standing water as much as possible. Each was intent upon some important task. To look at them was as much as to see a column of ants hurrying about their chores with more than the usual amount of vigor. In a constant parade to his chambers, where Prince Jaspin held court amidst the bustle of servants packing his furniture and belongings, came the knights and nobles, some of whom would ride in his train. They all came to pledge their fealty and support to his cause, and to receive some indulgence for themselves in return. The sycophant Antescu stood at the prince's left hand, bending close to whisper in the prince's ear how much this noble's allegiance had cost, or what boon that knight required to satisfy his conscience. A young knight who wished leave to take back by right of the point of his lance the lands of his father, which he had squandered away in dissipation, entered and knelt before Jaspin. He pleaded his cause when asked, and the prince acquiesced as instructed by Antescu's intimations. As the knight rose to leave, bowing deeply, Prince Jaspin spoke.
Will you be attending us to our summer castle at Erlet Fields?
If it so pleases you, sire.
Several of the younger knights and a few of the less secure nobles had begun using the royal designation as a show of deference, and it did not fail to please the greedy prince, who took it as his right. Those who knew better withheld their esteem judiciously.
It pleases me to have your lance ever ready at my side, sir knight.
The prince did like to be attended in style when he chose to move about the country.
I dare say there will be sport and games enough to occupy a young and lively blade, anxious to win some valor among his peers.
It is my honor, kind prince.
The young knight would rather have seen to the retaking of his forfeited lands, but a request of the prince was not to be trifled. When he had gone, Jaspin turned to Antescu.
You have sent my chamberlain and attendants on ahead to ready Erlet for my arrival, have you not?
Yes, of course. They left the day before yesterday, and should be even now seeing to your homecoming.
Of late, Antescu had weaseled himself into a position of growing consequence in the prince's estimation.
We may leave as soon as you yourself give the order.
That is well. I am tired of abiding this cursed tower. I want to see my own lands again. But I like it not that the queen has disappeared. She has been away too long and without sign or word of her whereabouts.
Why should that trouble you, sire?
Something is amiss. I can feel it. I fear not for her safety, but rather my own, while she is loose about the country doing who knows what. She may stir up a faction against me.
If she were to stir up a faction, you would soon know about it. You could quell it in an instant and have her thrown into chains for her troubles.
Throw the queen into chains? There's a thought. I should have done it long ago if I had dared. Still, I would rest the easier if I knew where she was. I would also have some word about my harriers. They should have returned with their captives, or their captives' bones long ere now. This bothers me more than the queen's absence.
What could go amiss with them? Are they not proven to the task and with cunning to spare? I warrant we will have our answer before too many days hence.
I suppose you are right. But I would go to my summer quarters in a better mind if these loose threads were clipped and discarded.
Worry not upon it. If you like, I shall abide behind until I myself can bring you the news you seek.
You are a good counselor, Antescu. I will tell you this. I can use men of your abilities when I come into my power. It will not be long in coming now. Sir Bran and Sir Grenet are good men, but they are, after all, soldiers, and understand not the finesse of court and government. You, though you may not admit it, have special gifts in this area, I perceive.
You are too kind, my lord.
Antescu looked appropriately innocent to deserve such favor. Inwardly, he leapt for joy that his goal was so near within his grasp. In all, the prince took 50 knights and nobles with him to his summer palace. Counting their servants and men-at-arms, the number swelled to 5 times as many. The pilgrimage to Erlet Fields, the prince's private castle, wherein he resided some 4 or 5 months of the year, was a drawn-out affair, commanding more regard than it warranted. But Jaspin would have it no other way. Being within an hour's riding distance of the sea, the climate remained somewhat cooler there during the hotter months, and though many times smaller than Ascalon, it was nonetheless well fortified and ample for any prince's needs. Castle Erlet housed his fluctuating retinue with ease. The coming of the prince to Hinsonby, the nearest village, was always a gala event. People lined the roads as the royal caravan passed. They marveled at the knights and horses, the weapons and costly furniture they saw carefully packed away on the wagons. It was a show well attended, with merrymaking and festivity. Jaspin himself usually participated, supplying a good deal of meat and wine to the occasion. This year, Jaspin was weeks early in his desire to remove to the safety of his own battlements. 2 things occasioned his somewhat premature notion. His own growing unease about his alliance with Nimrud, who was showing himself to be a perverse and ambitious ally, and his wish to remain apart from Ascalon until the Council of Regents should meet and declare him king. Then he planned a glorious triumphal entrance to the great city as its monarch. He did not wish to lessen the impact of his brightest moment by remaining in Ascalon until the deed was accomplished. Jaspin reveled in the pomp and splendor of such events. He knew how to please the common people and woo them with lavish spectacle and cheap entertainment to divert their wandering attention from their troubles, and thus silence any defaming tongue. A chill yet sunny day greeted the departure of the prince and his army of nobles and knights, servants and soldiers, and various minstrels, game masters and ladies who had been invited to help while away the cool spring evenings. A day of good travel would bring them south to Hinsonby, there to encamp and enjoy a day of sport before removing to Erlet, another half-day's march to the west. The day proved fair for the journey, and they achieved Hinsonby well before dusk. The servants set about erecting the bright, multicolored tents used on these occasions as they took the broad fields just west of the town. Under the sparkling eyes and laughter of the townspeople, the tent city blossomed. A great bonfire sparked to life in the center of the field, and smaller fires for cooking flamed around it and in front of the various tents. Eating and drinking would continue through the night, and on the morrow a mock tournament would be held among the knights and the more adept of their sidemen. It was done for play and practice for the knights, and for the grand sight it presented to the people who would crowd the perimeter to see the spectacle of horses clashing under gallant knights, dangerously armed. Much care was taken to prevent anyone from being harmed accidentally, for there was no renown in being wounded in a mock tourney, and a knight indisposed was without honor or a source of income. Like knights anywhere, most relied on their skills at arms to secure the favor and patronage of a wealthy nobleman, those who were not themselves of noble birth. In his large tent, raised above the others on a wooden platform, Jaspin slept uneasily, while the raucous sounds of the roistering crowd continued far into the night. The prince, begging leave of his merry followers, had retired early, saying he wanted to present himself fresh for the tournament on the following morning. In truth, he had grown restive and disturbed, having brooded the whole day upon Queen Alinia's disappearance and the lack of effect from the harriers he had sent out to bring back the fugitives. He took to his bed in an apprehensive mood and fell at once into a troubled, dream-filled sleep, in which the ghost of his brother rose up accusingly before him.
Where is she, Jaspin? Where is Alinia? What have you done with my wife?
Twice during the night he awoke to the feeling of a lurking presence somewhere close by, as if someone were prowling around outside. By morning, he had all but forgotten his unpleasant night. The prospect of games greatly cheered him. All that remained of his midnight misgivings was an occasional twinge of foreboding, vague and undefined, as if bad news were winging its way toward him unexpectedly. But his disquiet vanished as preparations began for the mock tournament. The boundaries of the fighting field were drawn and marked with lances bearing red and gold petitions. Tents at either end of the field were converted for the use of the knights who would engage themselves in the combat. The weapons were readied, all sharp edges wrapped in leather and the points of the lances blunted with wooden protectors. Helmets, shields, and breastplates were shined, and devices and insignias painted fresh where use had rubbed them thin. The people of Hinsonby and beyond, some who had walked all night, assembled on the somewhat soggy Hanson Field early in the morning. Most had brought with them baskets of food and drink to last the whole day. Others bartered with the local merchants who took advantage of the sudden influx of visitors to vend special delicacies, sausages and rolls and spicy meat pies of a small portable nature. The midday sun, bright and warm before its season, found all in readiness. Jaspin sat under a canopy on a raised platform overlooking the field of contest. A score or more of his favorite nobles graced seats on either side of him. Ladies, their faces demurely covered from the sun, sat below, just front of the platform. Publicly, these fair damsels decried the rough sport of the tournament, but not one flinched from the clash of arms or from the issue of blood that often accompanied the games. When all contestants, buckled and braced and mounted on their sturdy war horses, had ridden twice around the lists, the marshal of the games took his place upon the field and read out the rules of the tournament to the participants, now lining either end of the field. Lots had been drawn to decide the order of the knights to participate. Sir Grenet had won first place and advanced across the field, paused, and turned in front of Prince Jaspin's party.
For Mensendor and glory!
Prince Jaspin dipped his head, and Sir Grenet rode to the knight he chose as his opponent, picking him from among the mounted knights assembled in a long line at the west end of the field. He stopped before Sir Wilmar and touched his buckler with the point of his lance. The two then rode out to take their places at either end of the field. At the signal, both riders spurred their charges forward, lances held high. As they closed upon one another in the center of the field, the combatants lowered their lances and made ready to exchange blows. Sir Wilmar's lance splintered like kindling as it glanced off his competitor's heavy armor. Sir Grenet would have fared no better but for the strength of his arm and his own slightly more advantageous weight in the saddle. His blow caught Sir Wilmar and lifted him in the saddle, but Wilmar's excellent horsemanship kept him at the reins, causing instead his saddle bindings to burst. Wilmar's saddle slid to the side, and both saddle and knight tumbled over the rear of the horse to the ground. The marshal accorded Sir Granick the victor, and Sir Welma vanquished. The two retired to watch the rest of the games in peace, having won enough valor for the day, and the next two contestants took their places. The games moved through their course to the delight of the gathered onlookers. One after another, each knight tried his strength and skill at arms. The games continued to the delight of the spectators until there was a distinct disturbance that rippled through the crowd. The riders, awaiting the signal for their turn at the joust, paused and turned their attention toward the crowd to see what the disturbance might be.
What in Orphe's name?
The spectators, apparently frightened by some cause as yet unapparent, fled into the field. Some of the knights on the platform jumped to their feet.
Asriel, protect us!
The throng on the far side of the field had opened, clearing a wide avenue for a lone rider, who took the field with a slow, dignified, and somewhat menacing gait. Prince Jaspin's face drained of its ruddy hue, and his hands fluttered like frightened birds in his lap. A lone harrier advanced across the field and brought his horse to stand in front of the prince. On his shoulder perched a large hawk. At his side hung an awkward bundle. Without a word, he loosed the bundle and drew out the contents of the rough sack. The defiant harrier then raised high into the air for all to see the two severed bloody heads of his dead comrades. Quentin stood at the parapet of his room, overlooking a dark, mist-shrouded forest, feeling useless and disgraced at being left behind. His hand hung at his side, still holding the letters left for him by his friends, and which he had just reread yet once again. He turned. It was Molina, his aging nurse. She hobbled in, glancing at his empty bed, and then out onto the balcony, and smiled a toothless grin when she saw him.
Come in, young master. You'll be chilled standing out there like that. Warmth comes to these old mountains, but slowly. You'll be needing your cloak a good spell yet.
Quentin said nothing, but came reluctantly inside and threw himself upon the bed.
You are feeling stronger, I can tell. But not so much is good for you yet. Your feet are anxious, but your heart needs rest.
Molina paused and looked at Quentin's fallen countenance.
What you have read troubles your soul, my bold young man.
They left me, Molina. Why?
It could not be any other way. That I know.
Quentin rolled over and looked at her. The Kuratak were an odd people, and knew many things by many strange ways.
What do you know?
I know that your friend Toli waits for you below. Come, a walk will do you good, I think.
Quentin slid off the bed and shuffled to the door.
Here, remember your cloak.
Quentin took it and threw it across his shoulders, and went with the old woman down to meet his friend. Under the old healer's ministrations, Quentin had revived and awakened 3 days after Thedo and the others had set out. He had opened his eyes as if from a long night's sleep, hungry, and not more than a little lighthearted. He lay for a long time trying to remember what had happened to him and how he had come to be where he was. But the attempt was futile. Somewhere in the far recesses of his mind, a shadowy, indistinct dream still lingered, a dream in which he had a part. But it seemed long ago and far removed from himself, as if it had all happened to someone else, and he had only read the account of it. He had, in the letters Derwin and Alenia had left behind for him. Quentin had gotten up to walk around the room on the second day, and had explored the whole of the upper floor the day after that. Under Molina's tutelage, he had learned something of Dekra and the mysterious Kuratak who guarded the ruins. Dekra was the last stronghold of a great and powerful civilization, a people who had vanished without trace 1,000 years before Selbrakor had come to forge his kingdom. The Kuratak, or caretakers, had long ago colonized the ruined city and fought back the ever-encroaching weeds and wildlife, and from time to time even discouraged squatters from settling there. From the dust of crumbling walls and columns in the once proud city of a highborn race, the caretakers had rescued the memory of Dekra and its inhabitants. They had delved deeply into their past, learned their ways and customs, and it even affected restoration of much of the ancient city's common square, or the seat of the government. It was here Quentin and the others had been housed, in the lofty, many-roomed palace of the governor of Dekra, which now served as the central command dwelling of the Kuratak. Quentin had seen but little of the ruined city, but enough to know that the aura of fear which surrounded the mere mention of the name was totally unfounded. The legends which men told each other in the dark by firelight were assuredly false, if not outright fabrications designed to protect the privacy of the caretakers and their mission to restore the city to its original splendor, a task which Quentin learned was to the Kuratak the ultimate devotion to a people they seemingly worshipped as gods. The caretakers believed that the Araga, Dekra's original tenants, would someday return to claim their city. The Kuratak believed that in that day they would themselves become Araga by virtue of their loving work. Where the caretakers had come from was less certain, for they seemed to care nothing for their own history, only so much as it helped them to remember Dekra's. But the original number of a few score had grown into several hundred over the years. Outsiders still occasionally wandered to the city and stayed to embrace the work. The Kuratak did not in the least discourage visitors who held nothing but honorable intentions toward them or who wished to study the ancient ways. In fact, they were always more than pleased to offer the arts of the departed Araga to any and all who asked. This they also considered their sacred duty. Derwin had visited the city on several occasions, staying once for over 3 years. He had seen and learned much in the ruins, and had himself helped in the restoration of one of the main buildings, a temple to the god of the Araga, a lone god with no name.
Do you think I'll be strong enough to leave soon?
The pair had reached the lower floor. They entered a large area which had been partitioned off into smaller rooms, but which retained an atmosphere of light and openness, and what would have been a dark, solid basement in any structure he had ever encountered. Quentin, feeling winded from his walk down so many stairs, sat on a three-legged stool while Melina stirred herself in another corner of the room. Tolly, apparently, had darted off on another of his ceaseless errands.
Leave soon. That is up to you. You can leave when you feel you must, or you can stay as long as you wish.
Quentin looked at the old woman's gray hair and wrinkled, stooped appearance. Anywhere else, the woman would have been regarded as one of Orphe's daughters. But here she was as much a part of the natural surroundings as the strange architecture he saw and the exotic murals which lined the walls of nearly every building. And there was something in her spirit which made her seem as young and alive as any maid he had ever seen, although for Quentin, those were few indeed. Quentin always had the impression that Melina was refraining from telling him too much, that she knew more than she would bear him to hear. And not only Melina, all the others he had met in the past few days spoke in the same cryptic way.
Would you teach me something?
Quentin was watching her busy herself with preparing some small morsel for him. She turned to eye him with a long sidewards glance, her head held to one side as if weighing her decision.
There are some few things I might teach you, and there are others far more learned than I. What would you learn?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't know where to start. Tell me what you think I should know of this place, of the world.
What I think does not matter a great deal. You must choose yourself how you will go.
Melina set a small table before him, which contained a bowl of dried fruit and a cup with a warm yellow liquid.
Eat now. Regain your strength. Consider what will help you accomplish your purpose. And that I will teach you.
Quentin ate and did as she suggested, but at the end of his meal, he was no closer to an answer to his own question.
It's no use. I do not know enough about this place or its people to decide what would serve me best to learn.
Well spoken. That is the first step towards knowledge. Come. I will guide you through the city and we will find the answers you seek.
Tolly appeared at the doorway just as they made to leave, so the three started off together. A firm friendship had grown up between Quentin and the quiet Jer, who seemed to hold his friend in reverential awe as someone who possessed strong mystical powers. Anyone who could survive the poison talons of a harrier's hawk qualified as deity in Tolly's opinion, as in the simple peasant's regard as well. He seemed determined to serve Quentin as bodyguard and cupbearer, and he made a point of insisting upon learning Quentin's tongue so that he might know how to serve his master more efficiently. Quentin, for his part, considered Tolly's quick thinking and lightning reflexes in pulling him to the ground on that black night as the only reason he still walked among the living. The hawk had barely scratched the upper arm with its hollow, poison-filled metal talons. The bird was trained to the throat. So, out of gratitude, Quentin busied himself with teaching Tolly and taking up the task of learning the gentle Jair's lilting speech. He was surprised to find that after the rigors of temple training in the official temple code language, the Jair tongue was not as obscure as he feared. There were only a handful of basic sounds which were combined to form more complex words and sentences. With steady work and patience, Quentin and Tolly began to eke out a method of communication with each other. The old woman led them along wide tree-lined avenues, which in another day, Quentin imagined, would have been jammed with carts and people bustling to and fro, buying and selling. He looked at the tall buildings of ingenious design, lofty towers which rose with effortless grace. And although they used the same stone Ascalon's builders had later used, Dekra's architects did very different things with it. Their skill was such that even the most solid, massive structure appeared airy and light, well-proportioned and elegant. A city designed by poets. Dekra's only temple sat in the center of the city, and all lines focused upon this center. The streets ran in concentric rings and intersecting angles from the temple, which was large enough to accommodate all inhabitants of the city with ease. It was toward the temple that Molina directed them. Quentin walked through the quiet streets, some of them more closely restored than others, in a kind of waking dream. The city of the vanished race was an exotic, alien place, itself a city of dreams. He stared in awe around him, gazing in wonder at the strangeness of the place. He wondered what the people themselves had been like.
What happened to the people?
It is not known. Oh, we find things from time to time, and there are many theories among us. But the answer to our most perplexing question remains a mystery. But this we know. They left all together and all at once, very quickly. We have found pots still on the ashes of the fire that burned under them, with the charred remains of the meal which was being prepared still untouched. We have found in the merchant quarters money boxes left open and the contents inside and undisturbed. Once we found a table set with writing instruments and the fragmented remains of a letter in composition, the pen laid aside in mid-word, as if the writer were called away suddenly and unexpectedly, never to return.
The old woman stopped and looked around. Her face revealed an excitement no less aroused than Quentin's own.
The answer is here, within these buildings and walls. Someday, ye will find it.
What were the people like, Melina? Were they very different from us?
Not so much in appearance, maybe, though they were taller and stronger than our people are. That we know from the many murals which abound in every house and public building. Among them were many artists and writers of surpassing skill. One of the first buildings to be restored was the library of Dekra, a vast collection of writings. Many of the scrolls were in readable condition still. Many others have been preserved and restored, though it is a long and often frustrating process. But we have learned how to read their words, and many of the curatak engage themselves fully towards learning the teachings of the ancient scholars. What we have read reveals a wise and benevolent race of high intelligence. Their teachings are not easy to understand, but we have learned much. Much more remains to be discovered.
The three were moving toward the temple along one of the straight bisecting streets. As Quentin listened to the old woman, he watched in fascination as the temple grew larger with their slow approach. The holy place rose majestically over the tops of the trees surrounding it, all clean lines and pinnacles pointing heavenward.
Who were they?
Who were they?
The three stepped onto the broad plaza surrounding the soaring sanctuary.
They called themselves Ariga, children of the god.
And who was their god? Do we know him?
Many know him, but by no name. The god of the Ariga has no name. He is one, nameless and supreme. Their holy writings sometimes use the words Huist Orin, or Most High, and Peranimgadre, or King of the Gods. Most often they called him Dekron. the One, or the One Holy. But his name, if he has one, was never written.
Without another word, Melina led them inside the great temple. Quentin saw Kuratok moving quietly about their work within the temple. One section of the west wall, opposite them, had given way. Scaffolding was erected around the damaged portion, and workmen were painstakingly laboring with the rebuilding. All moved about their tasks with great reverence, it seemed to Quentin.
We Kuratok have ourselves become Arika in that we worship the nameless god as our own. We believe, as did the banished ones, that their god has many children.
Where did their priests stay?
Quentin was looking around. Most of the inner temple was given over to a vast open area, raised at one end by a dais, which was reached by stone steps ringing its circumference. He saw no place where priests could live, unless their chambers lay underground somewhere.
There were no priests. That is not the way you think of priests. The Arika approached the god alone, though they had leaders, men who had studied the holy texts extensively, who spoke to them when they assembled, reminding them of the various tenets of their religion. But no priests interposed for the people.
They turned to leave then, and when they had returned outside once more, Quentin was struck by a thought, suddenly remembered. A thought he had often wondered and often had meant to ask Derwin along their journey to the ruined city.
Melina, why was Thedo frightened of coming here? Why did he wish Derwin to stay away?
Who told you he was afraid?
I heard them talking about it. Derwin said from the beginning that we should come. Thedo was against it. Then something happened. Tren came with word that the Harriers were after us, and Thedo relented. What was he afraid of?
That is not for me to say. But you may ask Yesef, one of our leaders. He may give you an answer to your question, but I cannot.
Again, the cryptic reply. What was it that these Kuratok were withholding from him? Certainly he had seen nothing so far to be afraid of. He puzzled on this the rest of the day, and far into the night, before dropping off to sleep. The next day he awoke, determined to seek out Yesef, and put the questions to him. Why was Thedo afraid for Derwin? And why had he changed his mind?
Ah, we have luck with us yet, my friends.
Thedo had just returned from the shipyards of Bestu.
You have found a ship to take us to Kosh?
Alenia and Derwin sat in the lodge of the inn Flying Fish, waiting for Thedo to arrange their passage to the island stronghold of Nimrud the Necromancer.
Yes, though it has not been easy. I have asked fully half of the captains in the yard if we may be accommodated. Always the same reply. We stay far away from Kosh. Not for gold nor for the gods themselves would we go nearer. But one man sought me out himself, saying that he was a owner of a ship that would pass near Kosh and would be willing to land us on a friendly shore, if there be such things in Kosh.
He sought you out, you say? We must be suspect of any offering aid too readily. They may be in Nimrud's employ.
We cannot always be looking under every rock or behind every tree for a spy. We must trust our own initiative. We must act, my friend.
I am all for moving ahead on our enterprise, but we must be careful. Our foe is a dark sorcerer of great skill who shrinks not from evil of any kind, and his net of intrigue is cast far indeed.
That may be, but we cannot wait forever for a sign from heaven. Whether your god smiles or no, we must go.
Gentlemen, please, restrain your tempers for the sake of our cause.
Alenia had seen the growing restlessness of Thedo in the past few days, as they waited for a favorable result from the docks. She had often to play the peacemaker, supplying a gentle word or quiet touch in times of heated discussion between the two men.
I am as anxious as either of you to see the end of our journey, but not at the cost of enmity between us. That, I fear, would be disaster for us and our good king.
Thedo nodded, acknowledging the reproof. Derwin, too, admitted his irritation, laying a hand upon Alenia's.
You are right, my lady. Our purpose will not be served if we are crossing swords with one another.
Then come, good friends. Let us be resolved. Our differences are slight, and we're better put far behind us.
Alenia looked long at Thedo's worn appearance, and at Derwin's usually cheerful countenance, now clouded over with care.
My king has never had more noble subjects, nor any half as brave. His gratitude to you in this adventure will be hard-pressed to find worthy enough expression.
To see him alive and safe once more will be payment enough for me.
Thedo smiled, but the tight lines around his eyes were not erased. The party had reached Bestu on the island of Tildene after a rigorous march through the tangled forest surrounding Dekra. Their path had become surer and the way easier upon reaching the fishing outpost, hardly big enough to be called a village, of Tuk. There, they clambered aboard the ferry which plied the narrow channel to the island of Tildene, one of the larger of what were called the Seven Mystic Isles. In truth, there was nothing particularly mysterious about any of the islands in the small chain, only that the largest, Korathi, had long ages ago been used as a primitive holy sanctuary of a shadowy secret religion. Strange events were said still to take place on that odd-shaped, often mist-shrouded island. But Tildene, the second largest of the seven, was the site of a fair and energetic seaport city, Bestu. This commercial center served as the winter refuge for the whole of Mensendor, due to its immense sheltered harbor, which seldom froze during the coldest months, despite the island's northern lay. Upon arriving on Tildene, put ashore rudely by the rustic operator of the ferry, Thedo, Derwin, Alenia, and Trusty Tren had before them an arduous mountain trek, up and over the hunched and twisted backbone of the island, on a serpentine path, descending at last to the low-lying port on the other side. The journey was accomplished in rather more time than Thedo would have liked to allow, but as the group came within sight of the harbor, approaching like bandits dropping down out of the high hills behind Bestu, Thedo had been vindicated for his relentless push along the trail. The ships lay at anchor, their colored sails ready furled, waiting for the first good day to sail. As he walked the shore that first morning after their arrival, having spent the first warm night in weeks before the fire in the Lodge of the Flying Fish, Thedo had talked to sailors and captains of large ships and small. Each refused, some politely and others with bold discourtesy, to grant them passage to that accursed land. Their reluctance was understandable. Karsh, a grotesque lump of earth, the tip of a huge submerged mountain, jutted out of the water far east of the coast of Elsinore, Mensendor's sprawling neighbor. The island had long been shunned by superstitious sailors, even before Nimrud had taken up residence there and built his fortress. The place was forsaken by all gentle humanity, fit only for countless seabirds, which nested in the precipitous cliffs on the western side, and the tiny land crabs, which feasted upon the washed-up remains of putrid fish and hatchlings from the cliffs above. Thedo, with Tren behind, had stalked the wharf for 2 days before happening upon the captain who agreed to deliver them to the hated island. At last satisfied that his objective had been achieved, Thedo did not bother with the formality of inspecting the ship or its crew, relying on the word of the captain, a rather short, oppressive-looking man who called himself Piggin, to vouch a faithful account of its seaworthiness. Thedo returned to the inn humming to himself and leaving Tren to stow their few things aboard and make any provisions which he thought necessary for their convenience on board. Tren, after seeing to his task, also returned to the inn, much less happy than his friend Thedo.
There's something queer about that ship.
What did you see on board? Something amiss?
No, nothing I can say, sir. But I noticed while all the other hands aboard the ship in harbor made ready to get under sail, loading and stocking provisions, mending sails, tarring and whatnot, this Captain Piggin's men sat idle. Not one stirred a hand all the while I was on board. They stood about the deck or sat on barrels in the hold, as if they was waiting for something. I like it not at all.
Perhaps they are ready and only waiting for the first fair wind to be under their sail. So the captain told me.
Aye, perhaps. But I never saw a ship of that size that didn't need some fixing. Nor any captain that ever let a crew stand idle.
Worry not on it, Tren. I am sure we need have no fear. We ask only to be put ashore at our destination. Surely there can be no harm in that.
Tren pulled on his chin and scowled furiously.
May it be as you say, by Ariel. I still say there's something queer about that ship.
When Prince Jaspin fled from the games, so disrupted by the sudden and unwelcome appearance of the Harrier and his grisly mementos, he flew at once to his castle on Erlet Fields. Prince Jaspin, being caught in an awkward position, careful not to offend public sentiment, which held that anyone dealing with the Harriers was as much a villain himself, paid the savage, and sent him off with a minimum of show. So Jaspin called for the contest to be resumed, lest the people be too disappointed. Then he, with a handful of his esteemed confidants, left the field immediately, allowing that he had been called away on some detail of state importance. The prince and his cronies had run at once to the security of Castle Urlet, and there held a hasty conference to discuss the situation. The meeting availed little in terms of correcting the damage already done, and since the prince could not reveal the actual source of his fear, he dismissed them all brusquely and retired to his own council in the inner chamber. Once the door to his outer apartment had been secured and guards posted to make certain no intruder should interrupt, the prince stole into his inner chamber, a small dark room with no outside window, a nook hollowed out of the massive outer curtain of the castle. There, Jaspin sat down before the black, enameled box. Lifting off the lid and placing his hands upon the sides of the miraculous pyramid, he felt the pulse of power begin to throb as the golden object began to glow. Soon, his sharp features were bathed in the waxing light. He watched the opaque sides of Nimrud's invention take on a misty appearance. Then, as always before, Jaspin looked into the clearing depths of the enchanted object and watched the thinning mist reveal the dreadful mien of his malicious accomplice.
Well, what portends this unexpected summons, my prince? Lost a pin? A throne?
Nimrud fixed Jaspin with an icy glare. Prince Jaspin quailed at the message he had to deliver, but having no choice, he plowed ahead and steeled himself for the wizard's awful fury.
The Harriers have returned.
Good. They enjoyed the benefits of a successful hunt, I trust.
No. They returned empty-handed. Or rather, one of them did. The other two lost their lives.
You fool! I gave you but one more chance, and you have wasted it! You are finished. Hear me, you insignificant dolts!
Why, I know where they have gone, Nimrud.
Where have they gone, then? Tell me.
First, you must promise to...
I promise? Listen, dog of a prince. I give my word to no man. Never forget that. But I forgive you. Only tell me where the scheming wretches have gone, and I will forget this trouble between us.
Jaspin told quickly the minute fragments of what he had been able to drag from the Harrier.
There are six, and there is a woman among them, the queen, I believe. It is fair certain they have gone to the ruins of Dekra to hide, most like. Everyone knows there is nothing there.
There is more at Dekra than people know.
The faintest trace of worry crossed his wrinkled face, but was instantly banished by his haughty leer.
They will leave that place as they must. I will ready a special surprise for these bold travelers. Yes, I think I know what it shall be. You serve me well in spite of yourself, proud prince, and you have earned yourself a reprieve from my anger. It may be I can use you yet.
You are forgetting your place, wizard. It was I who hired you. You serve me.
I tire of your games and petty ambition. Once, it suited me to further your childish schemes. But I have designs you cannot imagine. But serve me well, and you shall share in my glory.
Quentin had begged and otherwise pestered Melina into arranging a meeting with Yesef for him at the earliest possible time. That meant, the moment he opened his eyes the very next morning, the day after their limited tour of the ruined city. Tully sat opposite Quentin over their breakfast, pointing at objects around the room and demanding that his instructor supply the appropriate word that he might learn it. Quentin, although it seemed sometimes a colossal chore, beamed with pleasure at his pupil's progress. Tully could already speak halting sentences, albeit simple ones, and could understand most of what Quentin said to him, though he could not always repeat it. When others were around, however, he usually lapsed into his native tongue. They were deep in concentration when Melina entered the room.
Melina! What news? When can I see him?
Not tomorrow. Not next week.
Melina.
Today.
We will go as soon as you are ready.
I am ready now.
No, you have not finished your food. You must eat to regain your strength.
Tully watched this conversation, as he did most others, in an alert silence. But then he broke in, speaking in his own tongue.
What is it that my friend requires?
Quentin ate and related to Tully, as well as he could, the discussion between Derwin and Thedo, their disagreement, and the final resolution that had brought them to Dekra.
This leader, Yesef, he will tell us what we are to do?
Quentin would not have put it quite that way, but after considering for a moment, nodded his head in agreement.
Yes, he may tell us what we are to do.
Melina, who had observed their talk with admiration for the growing bond between the two, now stood them on their feet.
Let us go, you lazy young men. It does not do to keep a Kyoratak leader waiting.
The three hobbled together over the jumbled stones of the deserted streets. Quentin again was impressed by the elegance and grace of the vanished Araga city. Even in its crumbling state, the abandoned building spoke of a purity and harmony of thought and function. Surely, buried here were treasures beyond material wealth. As they made their way along, occasionally meeting a group of Kuratak workmen hauling stone or erecting scaffolding around a sagging wall, Melina explained to Quentin who Yesef was and how properly to address him. Quentin listened attentively, careful to mark her words so he would not offend the man best able to answer his questions. They turned down a walkway or narrow courtyard lined with doorways which opened onto a common area of small trees and stone benches.
These are the reading rooms of the Araga Library.
Melina was speaking of the open doors. Quentin peered through some of the doors to see scribes busy over scrolls at their writing desks.
Where is the library?
Quentin realized that he had seen no structure large enough to house the great library that had been described to him. He looked around to see if he had somehow missed it. Melina saw him craning his neck, looking for the library.
No, you will not find it there. You are standing on it.
Quentin's gaze fell to his feet, and his expression changed to one of puzzlement.
It is underground. Come!
Inside, they crossed the smooth marble floor of a great circular room, ringed around by murals of robed men.
Those are Araga leaders. We know little of them now, but we are learning.
In the center of the round room, which contained no other furniture of any kind that Quentin could see, rose an arch. As they approached the arch, Quentin saw steps leading down to an underground chamber.
Ah, the entrance to the library.
Yes. Notice how the steps are worn from the feet of the Araga over the ages. They were lovers of books and knowledge. This!
Melina embraced the whole of the edifice with a wide sweep of her arm.
This is our greatest charge, to protect the scrolls of the Araga, lest they pass from human sight and their treasures vanish with the race that created them.
Quentin caught something of the awe with which the old woman spoke. He was touched as before by the mingled reverence and excitement, as if he were in the presence of a mighty and benevolent monarch who was about to give him a wonderful gift.
There. Yesef waits for you. Go to him, and may you find the treasure you are looking for.
Quentin stepped forward and placed his foot on the first stair. Instantly, the darkened stairwell was lighted from either side. He turned to Melina and Tully, who appeared about to follow him but then hung back uncertainly, and experienced the strange sensation that he might never return. Quentin brushed the feeling aside.
I won't be long.
He reached the bottom of the stairs.
Ah, Quentin, I have been waiting for you.
Quentin stepped forward into the huge cavernous chamber to see more books than he had ever seen in one place. Shelves three times the height of a man held scrolls without number, each one resting in its own pigeonhole, a ribbon extending on which was written the title of the book and its author and contents. So taken was he by the staggering display, he did not see the small man standing right in front of him.
I am Yesef, an elder of the Kuratak, and curator of the library. Welcome.
The man was dressed simply in a dark blue tunic, over which he wore a white mantle edged in brown.
I'm glad to meet you, sir.
Quentin was somewhat disappointed. He had expected someone who looked like a king or a nobleman of stature, not a short, balding man who walked with a slight limp as he led the way along the corridors of shelves.
Come along, we have much to talk about and much to see. I can tell a book lover when I see one. You belong here, you know.
Quentin moved as if to speak. Suddenly, the words seemed to fly out of his head, banished by a most remarkable sensation. It was as if he had been there before, seen it just like this, somewhere, sometime, long ago perhaps. He had been there, and now had returned.